Yes, you lovely people, if you're not already, make sure you give us a follow over on Spotify.
And it was saying that, you know, if you get told you're in this phase, you haven't got long left.
Hello, everybody. This is the Fozzcast. Today, we are joined by somebody who I think is a little bit of a legend, an MBE,
a little bit of a legend.
He is a big legend, to be fair. An MBE, a former professional footballer, made, 462 appearances, 9 for England, and a leukemia survivor. Jeff Thomas, how are you, mate?
I'm very good, thanks.
Thanks for coming on, mate.
Cheers, buddy.
Nice to see you.
Right, we're going to get straight into the nitty-gritty stuff, all right? So I'm going to give you a date now, right? And I want you to tell me why it's such a significant date. The date is the 4th of July, 2003. Tell me exactly why this is such an important date.
Well, it's a date that anytime it's mentioned, I'm back there. It's the day I got told I had leukemia.
Wow.
And it's a day I was told I probably got only 3 months to live, so it's
how old were you at this point?
I was 37.
Blimey, now I'm 38. That's a year. I'm a year older than when you were told.
Yeah. No, it was I'd just stopped playing football months before. Fit. I've gone into business, I was putting all these little issues that I was having, night sweats and losing weight, bizarrely, even though I stopped training. So I just was ignoring all that. And yeah, eventually Julie, my wife, said, you know, there's something going on, so let's make you an appointment at the doctor's. I went there.
How long had those symptoms been going on, by the way?
Weeks, months, maybe.
Really?
Yeah.
In typical man style, just kind of like turn a blind eye to it, it's fine.
I was putting it down to stress of having a new job, and I've invested into a business that I was learning about, and I was going off traveling to foreign climbs, buying kit for the shop and things like that, and I was just putting it down to stress. But there was something more to it. I had a lump in my stomach that I was pressing. It felt like a sponge, and it apparently was my spleen had engorged to about 8 times the size it should have been.
Wow.
But yeah, and went to see Dr. Taylor, Frank Taylor. Never seen him before in my life. Walked in there, he felt my stomach. And I could tell straight away he thought something. He said, let's do a blood test.
Where are we talking? Sort of like right in
just by my rib cage.
What, just like a soft sort of lump, basically?
Yeah, it was just, I was literally the night before, I had my sister down as well. She was going on to Cornwall, so halfway down for her to on the way. So she was stopping over, and I was just feeling this, and she was a nurse. And I just said, I've jokingly said, oh, it's something, because I knew I had a doctor's appointment tomorrow. This is something the doctor's going to feel tomorrow and say it's serious. But that was just like...
What are you thinking? Like a hernia or something, maybe?
Something like that. Really? Yeah, nothing more than that. Yeah. And he said, let's do a blood test and I'll be in touch. Normally it takes about 3 weeks to get the test back. 3-4 hours later, I got the phone call. I mean, I've spoke to many people since then that I've gone through similar, and it's all the same. You know, that moment of being told it stops you in your tracks.
And did they say to you, you've got a few months to live?
No, well, they did a few hours after, you know, when I went to see another doctor called Shafiq, who was a blood cancer specialist, Dr. Shafiq. And he was the one that looked at my blood counts and said, your white blood cells have been accelerated, but they're not doing you any good. Because white blood cells are normally there for your immune system.
They're the fighters, aren't they?
Yeah, but they were being churned out, and they were mutating, and they weren't doing me any good. So they were starving my blood of oxygen. So this is why I was finding myself out of breath. I was having night sweats and things like this, and it was a day that, like you say, that day just sticks there. And
scary.
It brings all the
memories.
You
had children at this point, didn't you, Jeff?
Yeah, they were 10 and 7, Madison and Georgia, and that's all I thought about. As soon as Dr. Frank Taylor rang me up, and I was actually in between two of the retail shops I had. I was on the A38, going in between Birmingham and Maryhill, and I was actually going past a pub where I envisaged my nephew had just started Birmingham University. I could see him in there enjoying a few pints in there in between lessons, whatever they call them. But and that was it. That was my mind. And this phone call just stopped all that. And I demanded that Frank told me what was wrong.
Yeah.
He didn't want to tell me over the phone, rightly so. My experience, as soon as he's saying, I can't tell you over the phone, your mind goes everywhere.
Yeah.
And you know.
Yeah.
And my only experience with cancer was my dad, 10 years, so more or less a day, he passed away after 6 weeks of being told he had cancer. But he used to smoke like a trooper. So in my mind, I could justify, he had lung cancer and it had gone into his brain. So he went pretty quickly. But all I could think of was my kids, my wife, and what's next. And after being told 3 months, it was a dark place.
Was he pretty quick at saying, listen, with stuff like this, the severity of it, how sort of quickly it's progressed and stuff like that?
Yeah, because I've ignored it as well for such a long time. I'd allowed it to get to this point. But it becomes a big, massive learning period now. You're trying to take in all this information. I was lucky. Mine was a chronic illness, but it was slow. But back in 2003, there wasn't a cure.
Yeah.
Or there wasn't a way of beating it apart from one opportunity of having a stem cell transplant.
Yeah.
And this was all explained to me the day after by Professor Charlie Craddock. He was a guy I got sent to, and he was I didn't know he was a specialist in this field. And he put me on a machine straight away, and it was like being on a dialysis machine.
So was this kind of like a trial at this point? Was it still in the trial phase?
It was something that they did to try and bring you back to a stage before.
Yeah.
Where I was seen to be in an accelerated stage of this illness. And I'd been on the internet the night before.
Oh, it's no good. It's no good.
Don't do it. And it was saying that, if you get told you're in this phase, you haven't got long left.
Oof.
So I was reading people's diaries about having a similar illness, and it just went missing. There was no good endings, So
I guess that's a different perspective, though, because, if you were to be diagnosed and say, okay, well, we've got a 60-40, 50-50, 70-30 chance of being it. But if you get told you've probably got 3 months.
If you've got a time frame,
what was your thought process at that moment?
I was just shocked, to be honest. But that's what I say. The next day I met Charlie and he started giving me hope. He said, well, get on this machine, see if we can drag it back to another stage. And then by the end of the day, he said, right, we've got you back to that stage and you've got 3 years.
Wow.
And that was like, wow. I was bizarrely, I felt for the first time in a good spot. I felt like there's something to be positive about. And then it was a time of really taking all the information and that was there, and what were my options? And the only option I had of beating this was to find a match for a stem cell transplant. But then quickly you got told that the only chance of that is normally is about 20% chance of that finding a good enough match. So you're just hoping that you're lucky. And I was. My sister was a good match.
Oh, really? Your sister was a...
Yeah, and that's where I'm very fortunate. I've seen, when I was going through the treatment, I was sat next to people, similar illnesses, exactly the same illness, and watched them fade away. It was a young guy, Mark, who was only in his 20s, and he had a young family as well, younger than me. And I just watched him fade away because he couldn't find a match. So, it was a brutal time.
So once you found the match and you're on all whatever kind of drugs and all this kind of stuff, what do you put it down to, the reason that you came back and you beat it? What do you think it is? Do you think you've got something inside you? Do you think it's determination?
To be honest, back then it was luck that I could find a match, and then it's down to the skill of the doctors and the nurses who were looking after me. And Charlie Craddock, like I say, I didn't know Charlie.
Can we give a shout out to Charlie Craddock, by the way? Because Professor Charlie Craddock is
a legend.
One of the best guys the world has ever seen, isn't it? Literally as simple as that. He's just an absolute legend of a man, isn't it?
Yeah. I thought he'd had a few drinks the night before when I first met him, because he was shaking.
Probably.
And he was a little bit sweaty. But after a couple of months, after getting to know him really well, and you get to know people really well when... Yeah. You put your life in their hands, and he's become a really, really good mate now.
He's the loveliest man, isn't he?
Oh, his family are.
Yeah.
Can I just add, we'll talk about, obviously, what you then went on to do in recovery in remission. But I'll just add at this point that Cure Leukemia, who you do so much for now, that you're a patron of the charity, as is Ben as well.
Yeah.
So there's a long-standing relationship here. And
Are you just a patron? Surely you've got to be like
what?
Ambassador patron or something. Like, you're the main man. You're like the pinup boy.
What you're saying is you're not.
I think
Charlie likes being the main man.
He deserves it. We can give it to Charlie to be fair.
I don't think you can have the egos in the charity like that, can you? So you're all pulling in.
This guy here does like grand cycling tours to raise more charity.
Does
London to
Paris, so I think that's what he.
Yeah, he does. Yeah, to be fair, I've done. I think I did the London Paris with him. Few years back, kind of thing. And like I said, how old's Charlie? What's got to be 60 odd, hasn't he?
He's pushing 70.
Yeah,
Charlie,
probably. It'd have been 60 odd, I bet, when I did it with him. But like I say, he's absolute genius of a man, like the loveliest man, but isn't afraid to get his hands dirty and get down. And he's brilliant. What a guy.
His enthusiasm for his work is what's got, you know, people in the blood cancer community now have been given hope with the work that he's doing, and people like him. Yeah. They're working together now. Back in 2003, there wasn't many options, but now there are. You know, you've got my particular illness is now a tablet.
Really?
You know, there's a trustee of Cure Leukemia who set up the charity back in 2000, probably about the same time I was diagnosed. They set up the Cure Leukemia because there wasn't an opportunity of getting clinical trials even to a starting point. So they proved very quickly, if you put a sort of a network in place, and they've got Coventry Hospital, they've got Birmingham, they've got Worcester, and they've
all
Stoke,
talking
and working together. Yeah. And they've got a population of patients that they could do trials on.
Yeah.
And then they very quickly found out they could accelerate trials, and pharmaceutical companies found that, wow, this is a good vehicle to invest into. So they very quickly got £35 million worth of free drugs into the infrastructure. And then it's a bit of a long story, but Charlie then, when I was recovering, I was asking him, what can I do to say thank you? And he said, we need to make it national what we're doing in the Midlands. So I went down and had a meeting with health ministers, because I still have profile from football days. I was able, bizarrely.
Well, it was a bit of a story, mate, to be fair. Yeah, do you know what I mean? It was a bit of a news thing. A former footballer, only retired months earlier, suddenly diagnosed with acute myeloid leukemia.
And that's how my girls found out. It was like, not a bong on news at tennis, but on local news, it was like saying that former international footballer is fighting for his life with cancer. And that's we were trying to shield my 10 and 7-year-old girls.
Of course. No. Yeah.
And they were just watching. We didn't even think. But I mean,
seriously.
Yeah. Well, yeah. But like I say, it's just Charlie's vision, is something that I've been trying to sort of fulfill. And we're getting there. And he selfishly sort of give his knowledge and shared his wealth of knowledge with other people. And he said, we need to do nationally what we're doing in the Midlands. And that's why I went to health ministers, I went to big corporations and got a pat on the back most of the times, but eventually got a national charity back in the day to support what he was doing. We had a 3-year trial, and then very quickly leveraged about £250 million worth of free drugs into the UK system. So that was a great starting point. And that I felt I'd done my bit in the charity side then.
So what you're saying, you're willing to sort of like, cheers guys, I'll see you later now, right?
Thinking, right, I need to probably concentrate on myself and the family again, because I was selfishly doing crazy things to raise money and awareness.
Go on,
and
like,
all that sort. When I was told I was in remission 2 years after, or a year and a half after my transplant, I decided to do a challenge which was going to grab people's attention. And I had a good friend who was following my story as a journalist, Neil Ashton.
I know Neil, big bike rider Neil. He's a little animal as well, he's like a mountain goat, he is.
Yeah, he's a good, very good cyclist, very good cyclist. And it was his idea of doing the Tour de France, because he followed my story. And one of my positives when I was diagnosed was reading Lance Armstrong's book.
Yeah.
You know, he obviously turned out to, he was winning, I think we can all say, in the world
mentality
of
it, though, I think is what you're talking about.
The cycling world was a different world from what it is today. Yeah. And but the mentality side of what he fought to get back to,
how he
to
did
win
it, yeah.
the tour was what put me on a positive. And he was raising millions of dollars for a foundation in America, and I wanted to replicate that as much as I could in the UK.
Yeah.
So he was one of the things, and that was the idea of doing the Tour de France back in 2005. I was told I was going into remission the end of January, and we decided to do that challenge in the end of February. I got a bike in April.
So you've only first started riding a bike in April 2005, and how many months later was it that you're doing a grand tour?
I found myself in July.
What is it, 24 stages?
21
stages.
Yeah, it's nearly 2,500 miles.
Oh, mate.
So this is the week before the professionals ride it.
Well, back in 2005, we did it 2 days before the professionals. So we were...
Every stage.
And we're going up mountains. The fans were already there. And it was a great lift.
Yeah.
But it was a great, you know, motivation to get to the top of every single mountain, because a lot of people in the world of cycling, the media, were saying that you're going to have to walk, you know, you're a footballer and this, that and the other. And and there was one guy who said, you need to respect the tour. Don't just sort of walk up it and, you know, just get off the bike and get in the car. And I said, I'm not going to do that. And I just sort of, like I say, I just recovered from this battle with cancer. I'd gone from 15 stone. Charlie said, put weight on before you have 15 the transplant.
Oh, okay.
He told me purposely, put weight on before the transplant.
Cool. I'd love to see a picture of a 15 stone Jeff Thomas.
I was a chunk.
I'm what, 14, late 14 stone?
Yeah.
I would love to see you as
I was Mr. Blobby, I was, yeah. But I came down to 11 stone in a matter of 6 weeks.
Is that because of the chemo and all that kind of stuff makes you feel that bad?
Yeah.
Do you mind talking about the chemo, how that made you feel? Kind of, is it bad as what people say?
Yeah, well, the initial start of it was I had to inject myself with a drug called interferon, which is a form of chemotherapy. And doing that twice a day used to just make you feel sick. So I had to do that for the first initial probably 2 months of when I was diagnosed, to help me get back into the place to get in a position to have a transplant. And then I had a period where I found out my sister was a good match. So Charlie said, right, it's time to clear your body of all the toxins that we've put into you over the last couple of months. And bizarrely, then those next couple of months waiting to have my transplant, looking back on all my life, was the best period of my life ever.
Why?
Because me and Julie had made a bucket list to take
stuff
the kids,
things to do.
Disney World, nice. Go away for Christmas. We went to Mauritius for Christmas. We had 3 weeks for so Christmas and New Year. And being a footballer before, never been away at Christmas.
Never, I know.
And just being able to do things like that. And with the girls we did, we went down to Cornwall, never been to Cornwall. Walking onto a beach in the middle of October, where nobody else is there, and watching the girls run on the sand was something you don't forget these things.
Yeah.
And yeah, it was just a magical time. But I knew in the back of my mind, I'm going to have the transplant in January 2004. And knowing that Charlie was saying that this might not work. And so you've got that in the back of the mind. But that period then was pretty special.
Did it change? Obviously, it's life-changing, clearly, but did you at any point since, have you kind of fell back into not appreciating things, or did it change your perspective forever?
It did forever.
Yeah.
But you do, normal life takes over sometimes and you get down on yourself, obviously, when things aren't going right. But then you realise it's not that important, really. You know, things aren't that important in the grand scheme of things.
A little trivial things.
And what you thought were really important. And we're talking mainly financial. When you're a kid and all that, you want to have your bigger car, you want a bigger house. Especially in the world of football, there's so much competition. You know, not you just want to get a place in the football team for one.
Yeah.
And then, you know, you do find yourself like you get on this treadmill of like, you earn this much, you should be getting this. And,
striving for stuff.
And the world of football has gone to a different, you know, different level to what it was when I was playing, but we still had that sort of, you were expected to do this, expected that. So you get into that mindset And so, but when something happens like this, it just totally changes everything. You start appreciating the such trivial things, you know, like insignificant things, like even just going out for a walk and walking the dogs, being able to do that and and looking at things. I used to look at people and say, I actually look at trees now. Or really? I actually look at leaves growing on trees. I had this period from, like when I was training for the tour in 2005, I was enjoying looking around. I never used to see anything.
Yeah.
And he said, it just does open
you mean
your
on the
eyes.
Bike? You mean you like to look around and see stuff?
But even just seeing things in what this world gives you naturally, in Mother Nature. Mm. I never used to appreciate that. But now, even now, I just look and listen to the birds sing and all that.
Have you written a book before, Jeff, by the way? Have you done a book?
I have done a book, yeah.
This is like words for life. This is the sort of stuff that people need to hear. And like, this is how people should be living their life, isn't it?
Do you remember when Steve Jobs, this is obviously Apple, very famous, wasn't it? And like, it was his deathbed and he was saying like, you know, it's not the cars and it's people, it's experiences. Yeah. And like you said, doing that bucket list with your family.
Yeah.
They're the moments.
That's what life's about.
That's what it's about.
My life now is my family, really.
Yeah.
And they come first with everything now. And, you know, if I can help them still, that's my main priority. And just being able to just enjoy things. Because you need to experience things with other people to really enjoy it.
Yeah.
Because to share that adventure, whatever it is. So it's always something booked now. You know, whatever it is,
looking forward to something.
Can
I ask a question? Would you ever change a thing? Would you change it? Would you change it so you never had this?
Oh,
do you know what I mean?
I know what you mean.
Because maybe you wouldn't have had the outlook you've got now.
There is a fellow patient who went through a similar sort of battle I did, but she went through it when she was in her teens. And
what's her name?
Brooke. Brooke Evans.
Yeah, I remember. Okay.
She's a lovely, lovely girl.
Yeah.
And she couldn't get to university to do what she had the idea. She wanted to get into business and all that sort of thing. Changed her mindset. She came out of it and now she's working in the ward.
Full on nurse now, yeah.
And that's amazing. Yeah. And what she said, I wouldn't wish it on my worst enemy. But I'm glad I went through it because it's given me a totally different outlook and a better outlook. And I totally agree with her.
So I don't think we can answer that question. It is what it is, isn't it? It is what it is. That's what life is.
And life's an experience, isn't it? And it's good and bad. But you come out the bad and hopefully you've learnt lessons from it. And you move forward. You look forward.
I love it, Jeff. Can we just keep talking about the cycling bits again? Because you said a minute ago there, you got to respect the tour. You know, you can't go walking up hills and you can't get off your bike and all that kind of stuff. I remember watching, do you know the one where I think it was the Vuelta. You did the Vuelta one.
Wait there a second, Ben. Just quickly on that, Jeff did the Vuelta, the Giro.
And the
tour in the same year.
Yeah.
Which I believe less than 100 pros have done that.
Yeah.
And I know they're racing, but still.
Yeah, it's ridiculous. What an achievement. And so I want to talk about this one in particular where I remember, because obviously I follow you on like Twitter, Instagram, all that kind of stuff. So I get to see what you get up to and all that. And I remember this one time in particular, you were out in Spain doing the Vuelta like 2 or 3 days before or whatever it was. And there was one hill in particular where you were like, you're staying on the bike and you didn't get off, but it looked impossible almost. It was like that. It was an absolute, it was like a gravelly kind of,
like, yeah, it was 28 degrees. Oh, it was like
percent, 28%, yeah.
28 for, and that was, it was 14 kilometers long and it was averaging 10 to 15.
Wasn't the angler, was it?
Yeah.
Oh, horrible.
It was 28% right at the top. And it just, it's the worst experience on a bike I've ever had.
Talk to me.
One of my questions.
Well, I want to know the mentality of it though, because you, like the amount of times I saw you at the end of the stage or whatever, and they were trying to film you to say like, how did the stage go today? And sometimes you just couldn't even talk. You literally couldn't talk. You were so exhausted, like drained, completely empty. But then you know that you've got to get up the next day and do another absolute bugger of a stage.
Yeah. And to be honest, the motivation of what I've been through, the motivation that I've, has been all the battle with the illness and the people that I've met, they're the ones that keep me going on these things. Yeah. I always think back to the people that I've lost their battle,
yeah,
that I've met. There's too many to name. But they're the ones that I think they'd love this opportunity to put themselves through this pain. And so, you know, we're doing it for them.
It's almost like a privilege that you can do it.
Yeah. Oh, it is. And it is. And I think it's such an important reason why we're doing it as well. We feel like we're always going forward. We never felt like we're sort of doing it for just for the sake of doing it.
Saving lives, just literally. Literally.
Well, yeah, you know, you feel in some cases that charities, you're putting money in a bottomless pit. But with the battle against blood cancer, we feel like we're actually starting to win. And with the infrastructure we've got put together now, we feel like we can see the end. And that's fantastic to say from 2003, where a lot of people were just looking into the abyss, really.
What's it like? Sorry, Tom, I was just going to say, what's it... So when you go through remission, what are like the checkpoints? Where do you have to go back to the doctor every year, 2 years? How does it work?
It started probably every day at first, and then every week, and then every month. And then this sums me up, really. Because you've got a different immune system in you. I've got my sister's immune system in me.
Oh, okay.
And that's what beat the cancer, or otherwise I wouldn't be here. And I was on a tablet called Cyclosporin, and it was like a horse tablet. It was massive, and it was hard to swallow anyway. But when you open the cellophane, it stunk. So I had to take two of these a day. And I used to see Charlie, like I say, probably by this stage every week. And he said to me, we're a couple of months into this now. We'll start taping you off this drug. I said, oops. I stopped it a couple of weeks ago. And he said, you bloody fool. But I mean, that was my attitude. I thought, I want to get in control of my life as quickly as possible. Yeah. You know, to my detriment, really, because I've still got issues because I came off that drug.
Really?
I can't produce tears anymore.
No.
Because of that reason, because I
stopped
it.
Can't produce tears?
No. So yeah, you can tell me any sad story and I won't cry. I'll pull a face and I'll go really red.
No tears coming out.
No. Constantly putting little saline drops in my eyes.
Right.
But on a bike, bizarrely, it's fine.
Didn't dry them out?
No. Not bizarre. I don't know why.
What a guy. Before we move on to the football part, we're going to go and talk about football in a minute, but big shout out to yourself, obviously, Professor Charlie Craddock, Cure Leukemia. We're going to put a link in the description down below, the Just Giving page, because they are, like I said a minute ago, they are quite literally saving lives. It's that I've done bits and bobs with the charity, and first and foremost, the people that work for it are absolutely top class people. Everybody are fully on board with what this charity is trying to do, and long may it continue as well. Yeah. Bunch of top people, mate, honestly.
You've got Tour 21 coming up July this year. So you've got 25 of you this year.
Well, we aim to get 25 every year, but I think we're up to 19 this year.
Yep.
We'd like to get to 25, but we've got now the support of ASO.
Yes.
They have been watching us, what we've been doing on the bike for a number of years. And normally we always get in touch with them and probably try and not get in the way of the tour itself.
Just explain what ASO is.
ASO are the ones who actually own the tour, and they own other big events. They're a family, a French family, and it's a business that runs and puts
all
on the tour.
All the big races, don't they? They do Tarry Roubaix
and Dakar Rally and things like that. And they're a massive organisation. So we're their first UK charity partner.
Wow.
And we're hoping that lasts for many years.
Yeah.
And we want to build on what we did last year. Tour 21 last year raised over £1 million, which was amazing. To go into Paris is great. Anyway, finishing such a challenge, but to know that we've gone past that £1 million mark was pretty special.
Can I tell you about the time I did London to Paris ride for Cure Leukemia, where he said there going into Paris is a wonderful feeling. It wasn't when I did it, because we got sort of into Paris and you could start to see the Eiffel Tower, all that kind of stuff. And the last, pretty much one of the last bits is you go down the Champs-Élysées and it's on like the cobbles kind of thing. But before we got to that point, I said to the guys, we're like, listen, we've got another stop in sort of like half an hour or something. And I was like, I need a wee though. I'm busting. They were like, we're stopping in half an hour anyway. It's fine. So I was like, all right, I'll hold on. Got down to the Champs-Élysées and I was like, we stopping? They, no, we're not stopping. We're going all the way through this. And we was going over those cobbles, mate. And like, I'm sure it was coming out and it was going all over the bike. It was coming down the seat, down the frame. Oh, no. Mate, it was horrible. There's no worse feeling trying to hold it in when you're going over cobbles, mate.
I think I cuddle you as well.
Yeah, I know. Yeah, well. So I didn't get to really enjoy it, to be fair. But I've got to say, the 4 days I did was just, it was incredible, mate. It's amazing how you can go, like you're riding 60, 70 miles a day, then you get absolutely on it. Like you're having an absolute session of drink and then the next day you're doing 60, 70 miles and then have an absolute session of drink. It's incredible, mate.
I can't do it.
What a laugh.
But the Tour 21's got a particular challenge for you this year, haven't you? Because there's another significant milestone, but you're missing it this year.
Oh, right, you will, yeah.
so it's your...
But bring the mood down a little bit if you want.
My good lady, Julie, who is my rock, really. She'd been there, obviously, to a second thing and that, but 25 years.
Oh, she's put her foot down.
Married 25 years.
And it's day 18th of July, I'll be on a bike.
Oh, so you're doing it instead of that?
Yeah.
So you put your foot down.
Oh, wait there a second. Well, he's got a good excuse.
Yeah,
then.
To be fair, I forgot all about it. Last year when I agreed to do it, I said last year it was going to be my last one.
Yeah.
And
how old are you now? Wikipedia quickly.
I know.
43, 44?
Yeah.
There you go.
Yeah. No, 57. I'll be 50.
Blimey now, Jeff. You're looking a million, mate.
Oh, cheers. Thank you. I said last year, last one, and I was adamant that was going to be the case. But there was a guy came up to me and he sponsored one of the days last year. And Mark said, I'm going to do it next year. I went, oh, great, you'll love it. He said, I'll do it if you do it. And then we started saying, no. And another long story cut short, we got up £200,000 and we shook hands. So that's one reason why I'm doing it.
Wow.
But I lost a really good friend last year in Jeff Hill, who was chief editor of ITN News. And he was a Crystal Palace fan, known him for years, and he helped me out. He was a producer and editor on Satanta.
Yeah.
And
wow, do you remember that?
I used to do that Saturday.
Did you? On the panel kind of thing?
Yeah.
Wow.
And it wasn't like Sky. We didn't have headphones. All we had was a TV below a glass table.
So for people at home are wondering what the heck Satanta is. So it was like back in the day, probably 15 years ago or something?
Yeah.
About 15 years ago, this company called Satanta Sports it was, basically wanted to sort of take over from Sky, didn't they? They wanted to challenge Sky and start showing games and like doing Soccer Saturday kind of thing. And it lasted for, a year or so maybe? And then that was it. It kind of just went bust and that was it. Never to be seen again kind of thing. So you were doing it for Satanta. Okay.
Yeah, it was good fun. Yeah. Good fun. And Jeff was like teaching me, and I did make a cock up with one game. It was an England game and I'd named somebody,
got it wrong,
got the wrong name and all that sort of thing. He said, don't worry, nobody's watching, you know. And it was like, well, Jeff sadly passed. He was only in his 50s, early 50s last year, young family as well. And I actually met him at a Crystal Palace game on the Saturday following Monday he was diagnosed.
Wow.
And he battled, and he just couldn't get well enough to go on a clinical trial. And he was coming on board. He wanted to be a trustee of the charity. And he had grand ideas how he was going to help. But sadly passed away last year. So
shame.
I really want to do a lot in his name. I want to ride. And he'll be in my mind when I'm...
So is this the last one then? Is this the final
farewell? I'm not going to say it's the last one ever.
Don't. Do you know why? Because I don't want you to, because I hope, well, not hopefully, but I should be retiring in the next year or two. Three, four, five. And I really want to do one of these with you, Jeff. I do. I don't know if I'll be able to do it.
You've got to do all of it, though.
Oh, of course, for sure. I don't know if I can do it physically. I don't know if I could do it, honestly, because I'm a big bloke.
Of course you will.
I'm
you know, when I first started riding back in 2005, I went out with Magnus Backstead.
Yeah.
For a bit of PR and everything. He was great, lad. Great. He won Paris-Roubaix. Yeah. big strapping guy. I thought he was too big for him. But he was telling me about the tour. He'd never finished the tour.
Really?
He was huge, really, to like a just battering too much for him. The first couple of weeks. Where
I'd imagine some of the Hill ones, some of the big ones.
Missed the cutoff. Yeah,
the Queen stage. If you miss a cutoff, you're out, aren't you?
Well, I think as well he was in there for... I think it was set up differently back in the day. You know, the sprint days were normally in the first couple of weeks.
Yeah.
Or the first 10 days.
Yeah. Okay, and then you got into the mountains.
And then the mountains came along, yes. Yeah,
so. That was some time for him to say goodbye then from there on,
yeah.
He's no longer going to be a help. Yeah, but I would, mate, honestly, I would love to do one of these. Yeah,
I was going to really say, because with the charity with Cure Leukemia, I think once you get to the point where you want to hang up the cleats, Jeff, you need another footballer to take over on Grand Tour duty.
Steady on,
you?
That sounds like you're volunteering me for something here, that does.
I am.
Ideal. I'm far better.
The charity, Ben, come on.
You're a strong guy on a bike. So
no, honestly, mate, so that's what I'm saying. So give me another 3 or 4 years or something. So just keep doing it for another 3 or 4 years and then you're golden, all right?
Trying to think. Yeah, okay.
Right, come on then. Let's get a bit of football talk on the go. You're best known for Crystal Palace because you played with some big boys at Crystal Palace, haven't you?
I played
with some of the big boys.
Yeah, Steve Coppell was... You know, when I look back, I forget. He was only 28 when he took over Crystal Palace.
Manager at 28?
Yeah.
That's got to be the youngest.
I hope I'm correct in saying that.
Eddie Howe was very young, wasn't he?
Not 28 young.
No, but still, wow.
But he was well known for being an, you know, educated footballer. You know, he got a degree in engineering.
Why did he retire early? An injury, must have
been. He had a bad injury, knee injury, yeah. And so it was his first job. And probably a year into his career at Palace, came and watched me a number of times at Crewe, and I went down there and went into a dressing room and it was the likes of Ian Wright, Mark Bright, Andy Gray, midfielder, you know, and just some top characters.
Some of these guys still help out with the charity, sort of look after all that kind of stuff
and
as well.
That's the beauty of football. Yeah. You know, football is, you meet people on and off the pitch and they become friends for life, you know, and you, when you meet them again, you feel like you're probably about 20 again.
Hello, yeah.
You know, you just want to go out and do the same thing, but you can't. You're not allowed.
But you were at Palace for, what, six or so years? Obviously, people know you best for being at Palace. I know you've been at Wolves because you're a legend and they're my team. But it was at Palace that you got your England caps, wasn't it?
There was a number of us. It was John Solarco as well.
Oh, wow, Andy Gray got John Solarco did the Ride London, London to Paris.
And it was Nigel Martin.
Yeah,
first £1 million goalkeeper.
Yeah.
We had a good side. We finished third in the Premiership.
Wow.
You know, it was and Ian Wright, obviously, Ian Wright has done London Paris.
Of course he has,
great on the bike.
Yeah.
So doesn't know how to unclink.
Still,
he was
come
in
on.
The bushes every time. He's like,
Oh, imagine having some footage of Ian Wright falling off the bike because he couldn't clip out in time.
Oh, what he did, Ian, like I say, the guys have helped out a number of times when we've done charity. And I did probably 2007. We had great success in 2005. We raised £250,000. I won the Helen Rawlinson Award, BBC. And I felt there's so much more I can do with Charlie. So I was asking him all the time what I can do. So we did the tour again in 2007, where I did it with 10 cancer survivors, because I felt like, you know, it's not me, I'm doing it for the people. So I got these guys and Righty, and it was a year, it was in London, started in London.
Yeah.
So there was a stage down to Cambridge.
Nice.
So Righty did that. It was over 100 miles, first time he'd done.
Oh, I bet
so
he was
flagging.
He
was flagging. Yeah. So we had to put him in the car with about 20 miles to go. But we didn't know, like you were saying about your London Paris experience, he had to pee himself.
There's nothing wrong with it, Jeff. You
there's
know.
Nothing wrong
there's
with
nothing
it.
Nothing wrong.
But he didn't tell anybody until he got in the car. And it was a cold day, bizarrely.
Oh, that's miserable.
And he got in the car and Becky, who was doing the support, put the heaters up. All of a sudden, steam started coming off his pants and it just
stinking everywhere.
Yeah, that's it.
We've got to say, this isn't like an unusual thing for cyclists, is it? Like, the pros literally do this all the time.
Well, they're pretty good at mastering the weighing off the bike, aren't they?
Yeah, pull it to the side, boom, AVAX.
Do you remember, Tom Dumoulin?
He had a bad belly, didn't he?
Number two, didn't he?
Hits, what are you going to do?
You're on the bike for 100 miles a day.
It's human nature.
You've got to go, haven't you? So what about your England call-up then, Jeff? So you've had 9 England caps, which is obviously phenomenal, and how did you get the call? Was it a call?
It was just Steve Coppell pulled me after training, just said, I've had a phone call. Graham Taylor wants you to go out to Turkey. It was a qualifier, European qualifier. And he started me. I was surprised to even, to be honest, I was surprised to be in the squad.
Well, first time with the squad, and then you're getting started straight away.
Straight away, yeah. And we're winning 1-0, and he'd 45 minutes gone, and he said, right, you're off. And I thought, oh, that's it then. That's my England career.
What was the first half like?
I felt I did all right. It was me and David Platt in midfield, and I thought we dominated the midfield. And after the match, he said, you had the perfect 45. I didn't want you to spoil it. I wanted you to...
Wow.
So that was it. That was the start.
And brilliant.
Played 9 games. Got injured in between, so it wasn't 9 back-to-back games, but in the 9 games, never lost. But never scored, which was...
Right, so hold on. Let's talk about this for a second, okay? Because there's a clip I've seen many, many times, right, where you said you've never scored, but you did have one big chance at one point, didn't you? Again, I'm gonna put the YouTube link down below, all right? If you want to go and watch it, quickly go down there now, watch it, and then come back to this. But you need to have a watch of this video because it's disgusting, yeah. Honestly, it's filthy. So you get paid. Who was it that played you through?
Gary Lineker.
So Gary Lineker is kind of the it's a bit of a counter attack, basically. Gary Lineker's got the ball on about the halfway line. You've made a run on the outside. Played you through, clean as a whistle, one-on-one with the goalkeeper, and then tell me the rest.
Can't remember.
Oh, it's horrible, mate. It's horrible.
I am predominantly left-footed, and I always thought my left foot was, you know, I could do anything.
How many goals did you score in your career, by the way?
No, I had a good time in
66 goals. I've got it here, 66 goals. Right. That's not bad then, to be fair.
No, you can score a goal now and then. But, no, I totally duffed it. I went for a chip rather than
a dink.
So he's drew the goalie out to about the 18-yard box, didn't you? He came out to about the 18-yard line, and you've tried to dink it over him, haven't you?
It's not even got off the floor. He's not even got enough energy to really. He just crawled over the line to go out for a goal.
How far wide did it go?
Did it get for?
People said it had a corner flag, but it didn't. But
went out for a throw.
No, it didn't.
Not quite the corner flag.
I'd like to say it was the 18-yard box sort of line.
It was about the 18-yard box line. It was horrible.
It was, yeah.
Hey, mate, you played...
It's just the way that he came through and he looked so confident, like, have a bit of this, goalie. It's against France, by the way. This is against France,
France had not been beaten for a long time, and it was Alan Shearer's debut. I like to talk about the positives of that game. Alan Shearer, he scored on his debut, yeah. I thought I got away with it, to be honest. I thought we'd won 2-0, and I thought... They had Cantona and some great players.
Yeah, some big boys. Yeah, who was it in goal then? Who was the French goalie there?
Oh, don't ask me about going back.
He's got like a bit of a Buffon haircut, a long, he's like long hair kind of thing. I don't know who it was anyway.
He'd been in the goal for France for a long time.
So anyway, mate, it's a lovely clip, honestly.
That was the end of my England. And I never spoke to Graham Taylor. He never rang me up to say, you dropped. And then next time I saw Graham Taylor, I just got transferred to Wolves. And a year into my Wolves career, Graham Turner, who bought me, got sacked. And Graham Taylor came in.
At Wolves?
At Wolves, yeah. And then, obviously, little knock on the door in the dressing room, somebody asking, can Jeff Thomas go and see Graham Taylor, please? That was it.
Yeah, so.
So I was injured at the time. I'd done my cruise ship. At Wolves early on in my career there, and met him, but we became really good friends, actually.
Lovely guy, isn't he?
Top guy. You know, when you're an England manager, there's so much pressure on you.
You
don't get to see the man. You just see him for a couple of hours a day, you know, in that time when you're in England training camp and that. But he had it just sums him up. Steve Harrison, he had his coach. Do you know Steve Harrison?
No, I don't know.
The funniest man I've ever met in football. Funniest man. The things you can't discuss. Really, he's so near the knuckle all the time.
Yeah.
But so funny. And it just summed him up, what sort of, he knew what worked.
Yeah.
What a dressing room, how it worked, and what characters. And I thought he was doing really well. When he started his England career, I think he went about 13, 14, 15 games himself without getting beat.
Wow.
And then everybody remembers him for the negatives, but that's life, isn't it?
That's football, especially as well, mate. Can I just say quickly, lovely guy though, Graham Taylor. I've met him a couple of times, and I can echo what you said there. Watford legend as well, by the way.
Of course.
But absolutely lovely bloke. His family still come to the games quite a lot. His wife, and they're he's held in such high regard at Watford.
Yeah, well respected.
Yeah, really good guy.
And so the current England gaffer, Mr. Gareth Southgate. So you were his skipper at Palace, weren't you?
Yeah, he was. I think it was about 16, 17 when I first went there. So, yeah, taught him everything I knew.
What was Gareth like back in the day then? Was he... Because I've read a story about Gareth Southgate. He was like Mr. Professional, basically. There's a video, isn't it? Have you seen the videos where they're like, what do you like to do on a Saturday night? And he's like... It's like almost James Milner-ish. Like I'll have a Ribena and a salad. Or something like that kind of thing.
Right from day one, he was like that.
Really?
You know, he wrote a book with Andy Woodman.
Yeah,
his goalkeeper, best mate at the time, and probably still is. Andy, great character. Andy was like, he was like chalk and cheese, really. Andy was wanting to get on the beer and get out there after a game.
Good lad, he's a goalie though, isn't he? Good lad.
Yeah, great lad. But Gareth would go out with him, but then he'd be, you know, collar and tie, nicely done up.
Really?
Can I tell you about one night? This sums up Gareth. We've gone out, we've celebrated. I think we played Tottenham away, and we've come back. And we've gone straight out, straight on a few beers, and we're in a nightclub, and it was called Joe Bananas, this nightclub in Croydon. And there was a group of lads that were getting a little bit upset because Andy Woodman, good-looking guy, was making eye with one of the girls and everything. These guys got a little bit upset about it. It kicked off a little bit. And obviously everybody was looking at, there was a young lad that was in the squad. He'd come over from Canada on trial, and he'd been dragged out by the bouncers. They thought he was one of theirs, there in their group. And we said, no, not him. So we piled out to drag him back in. And Gareth, he didn't actually move. You know, he was collar and tie, didn't move. He just stood against a wall, watching it all go off.
Yeah.
And that
just
he
not
was
getting involved. I don't want to get involved in that. Yeah.
He was professional.
Yeah. Don't need any of that. Don't blame you, Gareth. I'm with you, mate.
No,
yeah.
No.
When you see trouble kicking off, mate, take moonwalk back to the wall and place yourself there.
No, he's a lovely guy.
So
top guy.
When you were like playing with him, did you... Here's a question for both of you. When you're playing with players, can you see that they are going to be a manager? Is there something about a player?
You can answer that one, because you were talking about the England manager here. So was it obvious from early on?
Gareth was always... He was captain. I was captain at Crystal Palace for 6 years, and he became captain as soon as I left. I think he was probably about 23. And he was a natural leader. And yeah, you could see it.
Really?
He's a bright enough kid from then. You could see that he...
What kind of a leader, like as a captain? Was he like a talker? Was he quite methodical, like he is as a manager, or was he kind of, would he write, you know, get the lads going, shouting?
I think it was a different era back then as well. You know, everybody was a bit more vocal back then.
Yeah,
and I think he could take that as well. He was in a dressing room which was a tough dressing room anyway, and you had to survive that, you know, with the likes of Ian Wright and that.
Yeah, of course, yeah.
And, yeah, for him to survive that and then come out of that and then become captain of the side as well, you know. And he was captain of the side that got Palace back into the Premiership. So he had success in doing that. And then he, I think, went to Middlesbrough and...
Yeah, of course, yeah.
Became manager up there as well. So, he's a born natural leader.
I think what Gareth strikes me as, again, I met the guy a few times, he's like this new modern wave of manager, isn't he, where it's not about the bawling and shouting and screaming at players and trying, demanding this and demanding that. It's more of a put an arm around them, speak to them on a level playing field and go, listen mate, you're incredible, you are, can you go and do that, like just go out there and do what comes naturally to you. I think that's what he's mastered with England. Do you know what I mean? He's taken away all the gumph. Like it's like he's harmonized the country.
Yeah.
He's brought together the media. He's brought together the players. Everybody seems to trust each other. And now it's like the national team is once again something that you look forward to watching, isn't it? Like you like it.
He went on the media side when he finished football for a little bit.
Yeah, he did.
Bit on ITV for a while as a pundit.
Yeah,
and I think he picked up then, it's so important to have those guys on side.
Yeah.
So he opened up the players, you know, managers before sort of put the players in like closet, kept them away from of the course, media yeah. side, so they didn't do anything.
It was always just constantly butting horns in though, weren't it?
I think it was what we needed, wasn't it? I think it was exactly what we needed, and credit to the chap, because he did completely galvanise the nation.
Yeah, blooming right.
And kind of, he went in there and must have analysed, and I know Steve Holland's really important to him and whatnot, and they've obviously gone, well, you know, let's bring the players back to the public.
Yeah.
Okay, these are all top-level professionals. I'm guessing they don't coach them to within an inch of their life, but with previous managers, you know, Capello, even Sven, and it's almost like we just needed someone to come in and glue the lads together and glue the nation together. And that's what he seems to be doing. Yeah.
But he's his own man as well. He doesn't bow to pressure from outside or above him or anything like that. He's very opinionated.
Mm.
And he'll stand by what he believes. And I think that's his success.
Yeah, it's good. It's good to see.
There's a lot of learning.
I was going to say another guy that helps out with the charity, like actually Gareth Southgate, he does quite a bit for Cure Leukemia.
Yeah. He does a lot. I think it was quite documented when he first took over. He would go and look at other sports and training methods, wasn't he? A little bit, I guess, like Arsene Wenger back in the day.
Yeah.
And looking at, I think Gareth was at like NFL. We would go to like talk to NFL
really?
Coaches.
Just see different, how that works and
just see what, because ultimately it's another sporting team, isn't it?
Yeah.
And things are sometimes always done a certain way.
I think you feel with Gareth as well, he's still willing to learn.
Yeah.
And in the past, managers have got this, they feel like they're on this pedestal where it's all about me and all that sort of thing. But you get that sense with Gareth that he still wants to listen to players.
He speaks so well, though, as well, doesn't he? He speaks so blooming well.
So what do you reckon?
Every single topic that comes up, whether it's a bit of a scandal thing, a bit of a this or that, he just addresses it in the right way all the time, doesn't he? Never misses a target.
What are your thoughts on the World Cup this year, Jeff? Do you think we've got a chance?
Always got a chance.
I was thinking about the World Cup. It's like 9 months away, isn't it? Qatar. How weird is it going to be this year, Jeff? Having a World Cup in blooming December.
I know.
It's bonkers, isn't it?
Oh, money, isn't it?
It is, mate. I know.
It
halfway through the season, though, I don't know how it's going to play out. You could get some weird and wonderful results this year.
Could be interesting. I think
nice holiday for you, though.
I don't know, mate. To be honest with you, but like I say, if I'm still playing, it won't really stop. I think we'll probably end up getting, you know, maybe a week off or something, but that'd be about it.
You reckon?
Yeah, it won't all shut down for a good like month or 6 weeks or something like that. Yeah, weird one. Anyway, weird.
Be interesting to see how the teams manage it, because obviously if you've got players going out to the World Cup and certain players...
It does. Honestly, the schedule doesn't change so much. It's I think the season starts maybe a week earlier, maybe finishes a week later or something. But that's it. It doesn't really touch the sides of it.
Yeah, they've got a good young side now, haven't they? They've got some great players.
Got a chance, to be fair. They have got a chance. Right, I've got a load of questions. Quickfire Q&A. You can go as deep into the answer as you want, or you can just give it simple. favorite cheat meal.
Favorite what?
Cheat meal. Food. If you've got to have some food, like you want a cheat meal, what's Jeff?
Bag of chips.
A bag of chips, like chippy chips.
Yeah.
I'm all over that. There's nothing wrong with that, Jeff.
No, Northern kid.
Gravy and curry sauce.
Gravy and curry sauce.
What's wrong with that?
Or not gravy mushy and
or mushy peas.
Yeah.
If we're going to, that's going a bit too far. You said
no
cheap.
Gravy.
You said cheap. Oh, no, chip. No,
cheat.
I'm not a chip.
Cheat meal.
Not
cheat.
Cheat
meal.
Cheat.
Cheat.
Like, yeah.
You said cheat.
No, as in, right, you've done 80 miles on the bike. You've got free run to have your guilty pleasure, whatever you want.
Oh,
what are you going for?
Cheap, you know, mate. They cost like a fiver now.
Yeah, no, they don't.
No, I've not eaten meat now for 5 years.
Have you not?
Really?
I didn't know.
Vegan.
Five,
didn't know that.
Well, not vegan.
Veggie.
Pescatarian.
Oh, okay.
I cop out, you know. I see the fish has got a chance of getting away. So, yeah.
It's a fair fight. He's got a fair fight.
No, so I just love curries and things like that.
Yeah.
Cakes. I thought you're cheap chips man. And peas.
Chips ain't cheap, mate, all right. Who were your idols growing up?
Colin Bell,
okay.
I was
Man City?
Yeah, I was born right next to Main Road football pitch ground, literally a stone's throw away.
Did they? Was this a joke when I was growing up, or did they have a stand called the Bell End?
Oh, that's what they were going to call one of the stands when they moved, weren't they?
And they didn't. They didn't in the end, I don't think. No.
Well, there was,
I don't know. Maybe
there's a Colin Bell room, a corporate room now, I think.
Right, got you.
But yeah, there was. But yeah, can't have Bell End.
I've got here biggest advice you could give to your younger self. That's a good question, isn't
it? Stand next to Gareth Southgate.
Really? Just watch him.
Just watch him.
Watch him operate.
Be sensible. I enjoyed my time back then.
Bloody right. Why wouldn't you? Is there anything, you spoke about your bucket list earlier, have you still got anything on that bucket list that you want to do?
Loads.
Go on.
The world's, you know, it's a smaller place now and you can get to everywhere. I've not been to South America yet.
Yeah.
I hear people that come back from there saying it's the best place. So, yeah, I want to get...
Travel. Love it. If you had to do karaoke, what would your go-to...
You don't want me to do that.
I know, but if you were forced, backed into a corner, you got to sing a song, what song you do?
I can't remember any words to a song.
It's on the screen.
The
you're right. Go on, Jack.
You can't think of any song that he actually would want to sing.
Probably You Too.
Yeah.
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 What?
Beautiful Sunday, Day? Bloody Sunday.
Sunday, Bloody Sunday. Okay.
Great song.
Okay. Favorite film.
I've got loads of favorite films, you know. But everybody goes for Shawshank Redemption, but I can watch that over and over again.
Hey, Shawshank. God, yeah. Don't get me wrong, it's brilliant, but...
Oh, no.
Where are you going?
Oh, it's a comedy. I'd go a pathetic comedy.
See, I can't do comedies.
I told him this, but...
I'm more the serious sort of...
Nah, I want to feel happy. I want to have a smile on my face. I don't like feeling
remember
like...
Remember when we went to the cinema? Do you remember? See, you're not good with any kind of that kind of stuff. When you were in Manchester, we went to the cinema to watch 7 Pounds with Will Smith.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, my gosh.
Horror, though, that is.
Yeah. Like coming out of the cinema, you know, double date and all that, come out the cinema and everyone's like, yeah, that wasn't much fun.
Yeah.
Jeff, if you weren't a footballer, what do you think your job would have been?
Oh, I was, you know, when I left school, my dad was saying get a trade. So I was a lift engineer for about 2 days, found out I didn't like heights. I was a painter and decorator about 3 months because I knew I had an apprenticeship as an electrician. I was 3 years into qualifying for electrician when I started playing football.
So what age did you turn pro then?
19.
I think that's a good way of doing it, you know. It's very similar to me. It's a good way to do it.
So I became a professional footballer. I had a choice of doing my final year as an electrician to be qualified. So I took a drop in wages to join crew. And the reason why I went, because they were going to Benidorm as a pre-season trip. I've not been abroad before, so that was
tipping
over the edge of being a professional footballer.
You take a pay cut just so you can go Benidorm on a freebie.
Yeah, 95 quid a week.
Is that what it was when you first signed pro at 19?
Yeah. I was 130 quid electrician.
And 95 at crew. Yeah,
it was worth it.
Yeah, but you get to have a chance to live in the dream though, don't
exactly.
you? If you could pick anywhere in the world to go on holiday, where are you going? Somewhere you've been before.
We've just been to the Maldives.
Yeah.
Beautiful,
isn't it?
You know, I'm one of the guys that can lie down and just read a book and just chill out. I don't need to be running about. Not my holiday.
Yeah, Maldives, I'm with you, mate. It's mine as well, to be fair. What other sport do you think you could have played professionally?
Cricket.
Really? Decent?
I had a trials at Lancashire.
Oh, so decent then. Yeah, you
left
were decent.
Fast bowler. No idea where it's going though.
I played
Central Lancs League in Littleborough.
Yeah.
And they had professionals that come over from West Indies. So we had Joe Garner, Franklin Stevenson, just great names. Garfield Sobers before my time. But, you know, just had a great reputation.
Do you not do any cricket anymore? No, you don't get involved in it?
Oh, I'd love to, but my knees are shot.
Yeah,
now.
I'm with you, mate. I'm with you. When you add your crew shirt and stuff like that, it does it.
I've had three crew shirts.
So. I've had three as well. Yeah.
You're still playing,
nice.
Though.
I know, yeah, just about, somehow. It's like I've got sticky glue and frigging sellotape inside mine. What's your biggest phobia?
Heights.
Is it? Spiders, snakes, no?
No, no, I'm fine with anything like that.
I love this, mate. Best moment in your career?
Beating Liverpool at Villa Park.
FA Cup?
Semi-final.
Yeah, nice.
We've been beaten by Liverpool 9-0 at Anfield in September. It's an experience for sure. Yeah. Ian Wright was walking off the pitch crying.
Oh, it's not nice.
He was sad he couldn't play in the semi-final. He was injured. He broke his leg. Of weeks before.
Is this the one for the final he was telling us about that he sort of played not fit, very fit?
He came on. Yeah. He'd only been training for about 3 or 4 weeks. Came on and scored 2 goals.
Yeah.
We're 3-2 up against Man United with 7 minutes to go in extra time. I was captain, Manchester boy, thinking, going to beat the Reds and Mark Hughes.
Oh, if only.
If only.
If only. Yeah. Bloody hell. Lowest moment in your career. Might have been that.
It might have been that. Crying on Wembley when I could cry,
When I could cry.
When I could cry, yeah. I remember looking up and watching the lights all flash and Brian Robson lifting the cup.
Toughest opposition, like, because you... Like,
opponent.
Yeah, toughest opponent you played against.
I used to love playing against... Physical, tough.
Did you?
Yeah.
Who did you enjoy the battle against then?
We used to share a ground. Well, we shared a ground with Wimbledon.
Yeah. Remember back
so
in
Vinnie
day,
Jones
yeah.
and Dennis Wise and all that. And Fashion You.
Cool. The crazy gang.
And yeah, we used to have some great games against them.
Good old ding dongs. That's back in the day when you could put tackles in and proper challenges.
Well, you had a few before you got a warning off the referee.
Yeah, they'd let it ride for a bit, wouldn't
it? Go, yeah.
10 minutes before a yellow card at least.
Yeah. Best player you played with?
Oh, I'll doubt him, right?
Yeah.
Must have money.
I know, a lot of people saying
best
this,
player you played against?
Probably the experience of everything was Gascoigne when he was playing at Tottenham. You know, just being on the same pitch. I mean, we beat them at Tottenham once, but just being on the pitch. They beat us a few times, by the way, as well, but it was so much fun. He loved the game. And I was playing alongside Alan Pardew. And Alan used to wear his shorts were short, weren't they, back in my day. But Alan used to roll his up, so he was like
Super short.
And so Gazza was like
all over
the kickoff. Rolled him up to a point where his meat and veg were on show and everything like that. Come on, Pardew, we're having it today.
See, this is what is missing from modern day football is the characters like that. The people that have a smile on their face all game long. They're just enjoying themselves and going out there and doing it.
And that's why I actually watched a game today. Forest against Bristol City, and I was watching the guys on a good runner was at Forest for a couple of years. Yeah. Great club. But they were looking like they were enjoying the football. They scored a goal and everybody's smiling. I watched too many teams score a goal and they're like, oh.
Hey, how many times do Man United do that? They score a goal and it's just like, that's just what I do. And it's but it's not really, is it? It's not. You score a goal, you enjoy the goal. Do you know what I mean? Smile, celebrate, thank the fans, applaud the fans. Come on, let's have it again. But they don't, do they? It's like they're too cool to nowadays.
Well, that's it. And I think they think it's going to last forever as well.
I know.
That's what I would give advice to. Enjoy every single minute. Enjoy it properly. Don't,
right as well.
Don't just watch it go by and think now you've got it.
Mate, I still go in every day. I do. Still go in every day. A big smile on my face. And I'm telling the lads, enjoy this, you know. It's the time of your life. This is right now. You don't know it.
Yeah.
But it's the time of your life right now. Right now.
Wise words. Biggest cycling achievement?
Getting to Paris in 2005.
Yeah.
Which is the hardest of the three tours?
The tour last year was tough. And they made it tougher than normal. There was a stage that was over 150 miles long.
Ugh.
It was one of the longest stages for about 30.
They need to change that. That's ridiculous. 150 miles. Nobody's enjoying that.
No, but I think the Giro was like...
Yeah?
Yeah, it was tough.
The weather wasn't great in the Giro, was it?
Let's be honest.
The weather was brutal.
I can't imagine any of them are going to be easy 21 stages.
Nah, but mate, when the weather's against you as well,
you're
nailing it down with rain.
You get in the mountains, it's just ridiculous.
You had a couple stages where the snow and the hail and the ice and the sleet and the... Oh, it was miserable.
Yeah.
Miserable.
Toughest ever day on a bike?
Stage 14, 2005, Galibier. Yeah, again, it's another day that I can go back to because it was a day where I felt once I got to the top of that mountain, I could do anything. Because I had a film crew from, like, not Eurosport, but something that was like Football Monday.
Monday.
They were there. And the guys who were riding with me, I had four journalists riding with me. And they said, "We're only here to watch you fail." And I thought, I nearly did, to be honest. And it was 28 degrees. We're just in lycra tops, lycra bottoms, nothing else. 28 degrees at the bottom. It was 3 degrees by the time we got to the top.
I think, mate, it's obviously like, listen, we're at the end of the pod and that's been absolutely incredible. But you said that I nearly failed, but I think that's the reason why you are what you are and why you've done what you've done. You've frigging beaten leukemia. Like, everybody ripped you off, all that kind of stuff. You've got something in you, mate. You have. You've got this like steely determination, will to win, never give up, all that kind of stuff. And mate, you're a frigging inspiration. You are. Thank you. Seriously, I'm not even joking. You're a frigging inspiration. Some of the work you've done, rightly so, an MBE, a frigging legend of a bloke. I know I'm saying frigging a lot, but it's true, mate. So what we do, Jeff, is we say up the Fozcast.
Up the Fozcast.
You got to look in the camera. You got to look at it and put your arm up and go,
up
the Fozcast. Yeah. No, I'll do it first then. So like...
go into that again.
No, that's the beauty of it. We should have rolled with that because people love seeing that.
We can roll with it.
Right. So Jeff, what we're going to do is I'll go first. Yeah, you copy me after I've done it though. All right. So you ready? We look into that.
Exactly the same as you then.
Exactly the same as me, okay. If you can. Yeah. So ready?
Okay.
Up the Fozcast.
Up the Fozcast.
Up the Fozcast.
Hey, well done.
Is that it?
Brilliant.
Brilliant. First time.
Oh, okay. Brilliant. Thank you, Jeff.